Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
He's already here. Do you know where he'll be coming out?
Came in this way and then just U'd in. So,
do me a favor.
Yeah.
I'm on board with you guys.
Yeah.
But just no profanity.
To serve and protect, and when it comes to protests, no taking sides. An Ontario provincial police officer is under review after getting a little too cozy with a man protesting the Prime Minister, sharing his own political views and possibly sensitive security information. Welcome to Your World Tonight. I'm Tom Harrington. It is Friday, April 26th, coming up on 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Also on the podcast.
This is a piece of legislation that will undermine local democracy.
Backlash in Alberta over the province's plan to take more control over municipalities, including the power to replace councillors and repeal bylaws. Plus,
you know, certainly look at the positive, but I'm also like right away, okay, what's next?
After being trapped for weeks in a BC lagoon, a stranded orca whale gets closer to the open ocean and her pod. The Ontario Provincial Police are reviewing video of an on-duty officer expressing solidarity with an anti-Trudeau protester. The interaction happened this week, and it's raising questions about the safety of the Prime Minister and the professionalism of the police. Tom Parry has our top story.
Protest for Justin Trudeau here at the Honda plant in Alliston.
Wherever Justin Trudeau goes these days, protesters are almost sure to follow. So when the Prime Minister arrived in Alliston, Ontario this week to announce a big new investment in the auto sector, he was greeted by a small but noisy group, shouting, waving their F. Trudeau flags and broadcasting all of it on social media.
Do you know which entrance he is going to be coming out? He's what?
He's already here.
Do you know where he'll be coming out?
He came in this way and then just U'd in, so...
One protester recording a brief conversation with an Ontario provincial police officer who lets him know the Prime Minister has already arrived and then keeps talking.
Do me a favor.
Yeah.
I'm on board with you guys.
Yeah.
But just no profanity.
Yeah. The conversation continues, with the officer assuring the protester there are 6,000 OPP members, and he's pretty sure not all of them voted for Trudeau. After some more banter, the protester goes on his way and thanks the officer for his support. Today, the OPP responded. Acting Staff Sergeant Robert Simpson says the force is aware of the online post and the matter is under review.
The video has raised concerns about professionalism and depicts opinions that are not in line with the OPP's values.
Charles Bordelot, the former chief of the Ottawa Police Service, has seen the video and has two main concerns. One, that the officer may have disclosed operational information by telling the protester where the PM drove in, and two, that the officer appeared to be taking sides.
Well, he's expressed his own personal opinions on a certain matter to obtain favor with the demonstrators, and that's inappropriate for a police officer to do that.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau wouldn't comment on the video today, saying only that in Canada, there is a right to peaceful protest.
The ability to throw out insults at the person of the Prime Minister is something that is protected here in Canada and is really important for people to be able to express themselves.
During the convoy protests of 2022, another OPP officer was caught on video expressing his support for the protest movement. Charles Bordelot says police need to stay neutral and above all professional, keeping in mind that these days, chances are they're on camera. Tom Parry, CBC News, Ottawa.
Local elections and governments in Alberta's cities and towns may never be the same. A bill proposed by the United Conservative government would give the province far-reaching powers over municipalities. As Julia Wong tells us, the municipal affairs minister says it's about accountability, but opponents are calling it undemocratic.
The proposed amendments to the Municipal Government Act will give
If Bill 20 becomes law, the province's cabinet would have the ability to force a local government to change or amend bylaws it doesn't like. Alberta Municipal Affairs Minister Rick McIver.
We are doing this in order to protect the provincial interest by ensuring municipalities are governing affairs that are within their jurisdiction.
The bill would also give Alberta's cabinet the authority to dismiss a councillor if it's in the public interest, though McIver could not define exactly what that is.
Well, what's in the public interest would be a case-by-case basis. If cabinet makes a flippant decision, or one that the public thinks is, you called it a witch hunt, I think that the cabinet would be a great risk of being held accountable at the next general provincial election.
Municipalities get their powers from provincial legislation.
They've cleared the pathway to relatively speedy and efficient interference.
But this level of involvement is concerning, according to University of Alberta law professor Eric Adams.
A number of decisions would be made around the cabinet table, would not be debated in the legislature, would not be necessarily subject to public scrutiny, and a city would have to either comply or have a city councillor removed or have a city law changed. That's a fairly extraordinary level of provincial power at the city level. And
in Edmonton, where all the MLAs are from the NDP.
I'm not sure why we think it's entirely appropriate for a provincial cabinet without representation from Edmonton to step in and say, well, we know what's best for that city.
The devil will be in the details, says Brendan Boyd, a political scientist at McEwen University.
It may not be a huge deal. It depends on how often it's used.
Though Edmonton City Councillor Joanne Wright says she worries about the possible ripple effects.
And I wonder, in some cases, would that then maybe change councillors' way of voting? Maybe voting not in their public's interest, but in order to keep their job.
For the Edmontonians casting ballots, mixed reaction.
If you're not doing anything wrong, you shouldn't you shouldn't fear the legislation.
I think that's using power in a way that's not great. I think that they could create new bylaws that are more just specific to what they would want.
The bill would also ban electronic voting machines and set the stage for political parties on the local level, with a pilot project in Edmonton and Calgary. The Alberta government says it will work on regulations in consultation with municipalities in the coming months if the legislation passes. Julia Wong, CBC News, Edmonton.
BC's premier says public drug use will no longer be allowed in the province. David Eby made the announcement today, saying a decriminalization pilot project has compromised public safety.
The drugs that we're seeing in our communities are more dangerous and more deadly than ever before. People have transitioned from injecting drugs to inhaling drugs. The impacts are very real on communities. Illicit drugs and hard drugs should not be used where kids are playing, where patients are recovering, where community life is lived.
The NDP government has been under fire from health workers, police, and some municipal politicians over open drug use. Eby says people will still be allowed to use illicit and hard drugs in private spaces and sanctioned addiction and overdose prevention sites. More and more Canadians are falling into poverty. That is the harsh reality revealed in new numbers from Statistics Canada. They show nearly 10% of Canadians live below the poverty line, a 3% jump from the previous year, which nearly matches pre-pandemic numbers. As Paula Duhatchik tells us, even buying daily essentials such as food is out of reach for too many Canadians.
Yeah, so we just package eggs. We do three per bag.
30-year-old Alyssa Gosling is sorting food at Toronto's Fort York Food Bank. She's been a volunteer since last summer and is also a client herself.
But sometimes you just need the help, and it's okay to ask. So, and a lot more people who are in our position are also collecting from food banks who never thought they would have to.
Yeah, so Friday is one of our busiest days at the food bank.
Food bank executive director Julie Lejeune says before the pandemic, they had about 1,000 clients a week. Now they have more than 5,000. She's not surprised to see New Statistics Canada data showing the country's poverty rate is on the rise, and so is the share of Canadians who don't have enough to eat.
And so you'll have a part-time job or a minimum wage job, and it's not enough.
I had expected these numbers to go up, but it's sickening to see how much they've gone up.
Valerie Tarasuk leads the University of Toronto's Proof Research Lab on Food Insecurity. She says nearly a quarter of Canadians are dealing with the problem in some form. Some people are worried about running out of groceries. Others are skipping meals and going days without eating.
We're now looking at a prevalence of severe food insecurity of 6% in this country. And we've never seen anything close to that in the past.
She says the rise in food insecurity was due in part to the end of COVID-19 benefits, but mostly because the cost of shelter, gas, and groceries went up faster than people could afford. Nick Jennery is executive director of Feed Nova Scotia, where food insecurity is highest in the country.
They're getting there sometimes 1 to 2 hours before the food bank opens because they don't want to be left out. Just people are just getting more and more desperate.
Quebec, meanwhile, had the lowest rate of food insecurity. Tarasuk says that's because that province has a strong social safety net.
So every day, Monday through Friday, we receive about 10 to 12 skids from Daily Bread.
Back at the Fort York Food Bank, Julie Lejeune knows grocery boxes and takeaway meals are temporary solutions to bigger problems.
Some of the things are we need better paying jobs, we need better housing.
For now, though, she hopes a warm meal will make daily life a little bit easier. Paula Duhacek, CBC News, Calgary.
Coming up, a stranded orca whale in British Columbia has freed itself from a tidal lagoon, but survival still won't be easy. From Mumbai to Manila, a brutal heat wave is scorching South Asia. Later, Paul Hunter is in Jamaica with Canadian troops who've been training foreign forces who will soon be on the ground in Haiti. The Grand Chief of the Assembly of First Nations says it was a humiliating experience. She was talking about an incident on a recent Air Canada flight when the cabin crew tried to take away her ceremonial headdress. Chief Cindy Woodhouse-Nipanak is accusing the airline of insensitivity, and it's prompted calls for change, even from the Prime Minister. Cameron McIntosh has the details.
We went through the gate. We made it onto the plane.
A short flight, Montreal to Fredericton.
Of course, I had my headdress, so my headdress case and my belongings, and you know, put them on the plane as per usual.
When she flies, National Chief Cindy Woodhouse-Nipanak takes her ceremonial headdress as a carry-on. It's never been a problem before.
But they wanted to put it down below, and of course, it's got cultural significance to me. And you know, in that point, I was kind of stunned.
Woodhouse says that led to a heated exchange with air crew as she explained what the large beaded feathered headdress was.
I pulled out my headdress. I thought, well, I'm not going to let them take that from me. They're going to have to pry it from me.
And why she was uncomfortable stowing it.
And then they took my case and they put it in garbage bags. And then they took it away from me.
She kept the headdress on her lap, but the case was put in a large clear bag, stowed in the baggage compartment. She says the captain made sure she got the case back promptly after the plane landed.
I think we need to develop a protocol for First Nations.
In a statement, Air Canada apologized, saying carrying the case in the cabin was difficult due to stowage space limitations. The plane, a turboprop-driven Dash 8, has limited cabin space compared to other commercial planes. The case, the size of a large duffel bag, is at the limits of carry-on size. Air safety regulations give the crew final say over what can fly in the cabin.
Perhaps that was a staff member doing their job and just not having awareness.
Leonard Weasel Traveler is the elder who presented Woodhouse-Nipanak with the headdress earlier this year. He says there needs to be greater education and allowance for items like it.
Cindy felt, you know, she was violated. You know, she felt, a dagger through her heart.
Other Indigenous leaders have weighed in, saying they've had similar experiences with headdresses. Air Canada says it's reviewing its policies.
Obviously, it's unacceptable.
The Prime Minister calls it a lesson in reconciliation.
It is an unfortunate situation that I hope is going to lead to a bit of learning, not just by Air Canada, but a lot of different institutions.
One thing that was encouraging, says Woodhouse-Nipanak, other passengers who stood up for her.
It's not like people just sat there and were quiet. People were trying genuinely to help and to say, just leave, let her be. She's not doing anything.
She says that makes her optimistic about reconciliation and flying again. Cameron McIntosh, CBC News, Winnipeg.
April is just the start of summer in South Asia, but it's already far hotter than usual. The region is in the middle of a brutal heat wave. Hundreds of millions are suffering. Anand Ram explains why the danger to public health is rising like the temperatures.
rickshaw drivers work the crowded streets of Dhaka even as the scorching heat presses down on them. Every two trips, I need to take a rest and drink water, this driver says. The severe heat wave has engulfed Bangladesh and its capital all week, even forcing schools to shut down, affecting tens of millions of children.
We have multiple problems together.
Riaz Hossein Khan is a scientist in Dhaka who has studied heat vulnerability. Temperatures reached as high as 42 degrees Celsius this week, but Khan says the added danger, the extreme humidity.
If it is high heat, then we feel bad, but not that much. But when it is really humid, we sweat, but it doesn't go away.
Khan has even heard of air conditioners exploding under the stress of this heat wave across South and Southeast Asia. Heatstroke killing people in Thailand. In Vietnam, officials warning people not to go out during the peak sun. And in India, fans inside polling stations try to keep people cool as they participate in the biggest democratic event on the planet, that country's general election. This voter says no matter how hot the weather, it's extremely important to cast ballots. But the heat is not easy for politicians either, with one even fainting on stage earlier this week.
Those temperatures are made 4 or 5 times more likely by the influence of climate change.
Peter Gerard is with the U.S.-based nonprofit Climate Central. He says El Nino, which warms waters in the Pacific, is still having an effect on the extreme heat we've seen this year. But even without it, human-influenced climate change is making these events worse.
We expect this to continue and these events to last longer and become more intense. And that means the human health impact is only expected to become more severe.
Back in Dhaka, relief is coming. The National Meteorological Department expecting a good chance of rain, but it won't last.
But after that, there will be another heat wave. Sometimes in the middle of May, yeah.
Meaning people will still need to find ways to beat the heat in a city that Khan points out has little open space, making it a sweltering concrete jungle. Anand Ram, CBC News, Toronto.
The Canadian military is wrapping up a mission in Jamaica, training foreign troops going into Haiti. Months of gang violence have destabilized that country, leading to the creation of a transitional council now in power. Paul Hunter traveled to Jamaica for an exclusive look at the work the Canadian troops have been doing.
At an old prison compound outside Kingston, Jamaica, the sound of gunfire, along with shouting helicopters and military vehicles racing across the terrain. It's the culmination of 4 weeks of military training for troops from Jamaica, Bahamas, and Belize under the guidance of Canadian forces, mostly from Valcartier, Quebec. All of it with a singular goal in mind, Haiti, its capital now all but overrun by paramilitary gangs. The Canadian forces have spent 4 weeks training their counterparts from the three Caribbean countries to get them set to go into Haiti in a mission to be led by troops from Kenya. Today's final exercise, meant to simulate what they might encounter in Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince, was extremely realistic, though no live ammunition was used. It highlighted a key aspect of the Canadian training, first aid in a combat zone, keeping a careful eye on all of it. Military and government leaders from a number of countries, including, of course, Jamaica, giving thanks today to the work from Canada.
It has been phenomenal. I think it has demonstrated the Canadian government's very real commitment to ensuring that it is a part of creating change in Haiti.
But, says Kamina Johnson-Smith, Jamaica's foreign affairs minister, more is needed from Canada and other countries before these troops could deploy alongside those from Kenya.
What we do need is the financial support and the equipment support from our larger developed countries to make sure that they are force effective when they deploy.
And for the Caribbean troops, that's a key factor on timing. And so the question of when they'll go into Haiti remains unclear. The head of the Canadian Forces contingent here, Tariq Massous, told CBC, for the moment, this work is done.
I feel good about it. It is absolutely a tremendous commitment by Canada, and we delivered on that commitment.
In Haiti, the challenges are enormous. Well-armed paramilitary groups now control almost all of the capital. Hundreds of thousands of Haitians live in misery and fear of killings, kidnapping, sexual assault, and starvation. The work ahead in that country, whenever it comes, is daunting. The hope is that the training for the Caribbean troops, now complete, will allow for the work in Haiti to begin as soon as possible. It's a start. Paul Hunter, CBC News, Kingston, Jamaica.
The United Nations closed one case and suspended three internal investigations into its workers in Gaza. Israel has accused 19 UNRWA workers of participating in the October 7th attacks. A United Nations spokesperson says one case was closed because Israel provided no evidence to support the allegations. Another three cases were suspended because there isn't enough information from Israel. The UN continues to investigate allegations against 15 other workers of the aid agency. You know that trapped whale we've been telling you about in BC? Well, some good tidings for you. The baby orca, stuck in a lagoon on North Vancouver Island, is one swim closer to freedom. The CBC's Tanya Fletcher has the latest developments and a look at the challenges still ahead.
For weeks, experts and locals alike have been monitoring her every movement. Quisahaeus, or Brave Little Hunter, has been swimming alone in the quiet lagoon of a remote inlet near Zabelis on the west coast of Vancouver Island. But early this morning, at high tide, a big development. The two-year-old orca finally swam free, all on her own. The Ahedisat First Nation says a handful of people watched in awe at 2:30 a.m. as the young orca made her escape. She swam past the very sandbar where her mother died, then under the bridge and down the inlet.
Some positive news for sure, right?
The Vancouver Aquarium's Martin Helena has been one of the lead veterinarians involved, helping the teams on site as complex rescue plans were crafted. Exactly 2 weeks ago, they tried and failed. A delicate operation involving a sling, a crane, and a flatbed truck was called off because the whale just didn't cooperate. Since then, they've been trying to fine-tune their rescue efforts, all while monitoring her health.
You know, we were really worried the animal was not eating, was losing body condition, skin was deteriorating.
But now, the best-case scenario.
I certainly look at the positive, but I'm also like, right away, okay, what's next?
And that is the big question looming. What's next? The Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans says crews are now working to coax Quisahaeus further towards the open ocean. They're working with First Nations, whale watchers, researchers and boaters to track the location of the young whale's pod.
So this young whale, being by itself, faces several challenges.
The first will be finding food, says Robert Michaud with the Group for Research and Education on Marine Mammals in Quebec. The second will be finding her family.
It can take a long time. In the meantime, you might meet other group being adopted as a transition.
He and other experts agree it is possible for her to successfully reintegrate, but a lot of things still need to go right. The reason for optimism is history.
There have been at least two incidents of this type that I've known of over the last 20 years. Eventually, the whales did find their family group. They survived. So chances are that this whale can make it.
He says these situations always come down to one choice, whether to let nature take its course or proceed with human intervention. In this case, experts have already intervened by feeding the young whale while it was in the lagoon. Now the ability to help is diminishing, but the outcome no less significant.
Because this population is so endangered, the fate or the survival of even one single individual is not trivial.
So while one chapter is finished, the story of Quisahaeus is nowhere near over. Tanya Fletcher, CBC News, Vancouver.
We will end tonight with a mystery. A Canadian family in the Scottish Highlands peering through the mist at the fabled Loch Ness.
And I just looked out and saw something. And you logically start thinking it could be a seal, it could be a beaver, it could be an otter.
Shannon Wiseman and Perry Maugham told their tale to CBC Vancouver's On the Coast program about what they saw, swear they saw, a few weeks back after visiting Scotland with their two young sons. Some sort of creature in the water. But how big? What color? What shape? A mirage? A monster? A moose?
It was probably... I don't know.
It was bigger than a Sasquatch, but smaller than Ogopogo.
Easy for Canadians to joke about, but serious stuff for the Scots. The visitors had pictures and immediately turned them over to local authorities.
And I found the official Loch Ness sightings registry, which I'm sure many listeners frequent on a regular basis. Didn't think about it until the next day when the Loch Ness people got back to me and they go, oh, we've had this verified by one of our experts and this is like the first confirmed sighting this year.
From there, the media ran with it. For British tabloids, this is right up there with misbehaving footballers, and the Royals. Nessie in view, read the Scottish Sun. Family snaps compelling photo, according to the Daily Mirror. Wiseman and Mom still aren't exactly sure what they saw. But Nessie or not, they've added their own contribution to one of the world's most enduring legends. This has been Your World Tonight for Friday, April 26th. I'm Tom Harrington. Thanks for listening tonight. Stay safe and take care of each other.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.